Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're going to tackle something you probably think you've got down pat. Prime numbers.
Right.
We all learned, you know, a prime is only divisible by one in itself. Seems simple enough.
It does, doesn't it?
But what if that definition, the one we all take for granted, is maybe built on a slightly shaky foundation, or at least not the whole story?
Well, that standard definition works. It's functional. But yeah, it definitely hides some, let's say, interesting questions.
Especially about the number one.
Exactly. That's the big one, isn't it? Why isn't one prime? I mean, if the rule is divisible by one and itself, one fits perfectly. So why kick it out of the club? That little puzzle is our launch pad today. We're diving into a really fascinating paper by Gary O. Langford. It's called A Myriological Logic of Prime Numbers.
Myriological logic. Yeah, it's quite a title.
It really is. And it proposes this totally fresh way to think about how primes come about using something called myriology, which is basically the philosophy of parts and wholes. It's a completely different angle, not just math for math's sake, but looking at the philosophical underpinnings. How choosing definitions shapes what we see.
You got it. This isn't just about tweaking a definition. It's about seeing how these foundational choices can, well, reveal deeper structures. We think you'll get a completely fresh perspective on primes.
Yeah, something you thought was totally settled.
Think of this as your shortcut to getting really informed on something surprisingly deep. Okay, so let's unpack this this problem of one.
Right.
It might surprise you, but this wasn't always settled. For centuries, mathematicians actually debated whether one should count as prime.
That's true. Even going back to Euclid, there was discussion. And it lingered really well into the early 20th century.
So the modern convention, excluding one, where did that come from?
Well, it was largely pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fundamental theorem of arithmetic.
Sure. Unique prime factorization for every number greater than one.
Exactly. If one was prime, that uniqueness just vanishes. You could have infinite factorizations, like 2 by 1 equals 2 by 1 by 1. It gets messy.
Ah, okay.
So excluding 1 makes that theorem, and honestly a lot of other things in number theory, much cleaner. It avoids constant exceptions. It's been mathematically, well, very fruitful.
Okay, so I'm hearing it was a choice for elegance, for convenience almost, like tidying up the rules to make the game flow better.
You could say that, yeah.
But that raises the question, doesn't it? If it's convenience, not necessarily some deep structural truth, what is one's actual role? Is it really an exception, or are we missing something?
And that's precisely where myriology comes in.
Right. So myriology, the study of part-whole relationships. How do we even apply that idea to numbers? It sounds a bit abstract.
It is a shift, definitely. Yeah. Traditionally, we think of numbers like 5 or 7 as existing on their own, right? And then we look at how they divide each other.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Myriology flips that. In Langford's approach, a number's identity doesn't come from its standalone properties. Instead, it sort of emerges from where it sits in the structure, how it's built from simpler parts or how it helps build more complex ones.
Whoa, okay, so less what is this thing and more how does this thing fit into the whole construction?
Exactly. Instead of asking what properties make something prime, the myriological question is more like, to keep building the system of numbers, what kind of structural role does the next piece need to play?
That's a fundamental shift. It's like looking at the Lego bricks, not just by their color or shape, but by how they must connect to build something stable.
That's a decent analogy, yeah.
So how does Langford actually build this system? You mentioned it's recursive.
Yes. He defines a sequence, let's call it P, step by step. And here's the kicker, the very first step, the base case, P1. It's 1.
1. So the excluded number is the starting point.
Precisely. That's the first major difference. Then, to find the next term, say PM plus 1, you look for the smallest natural number, K, that's bigger than the last one you found, PN. And here's the crucial part. It can't be formed by multiplying together numbers you've already identified in the sequence.
Okay, wait. Multiplying together numbers you've already identified. Can you break that down a bit? What does formed mean here?
Sure. Think of it like this. At each step N, you create a set. Let's call it CN. This set contains all the numbers you can make by multiplying any two numbers strictly greater than 1 from the sequence you have so far, P1, P2, PN.
Okay, factors greater than 1. Got it.
So PN plus 1 is simply the smallest number bigger than PN that isn't in that set CN. It's the next number that's structurally irreducible. You can't build it from the previous multiplicative parts.
Let's try walking through that. It sounds complex, but maybe an example makes it clearer.
Definitely. Let's do it. P1 equals 1. Base case.
Okay.
Now for P2, we need the smallest number, K1, such that a K is not in C1. What's C1? It's the set of products AB, where A and B are in the span of P1 and AB1. Well, there are no such MB.
Right, you can't use 1 as a factor greater than 1.
Exactly. So C1 is empty. The smallest K1 knot in the empty set is just 2. So P2 equals 2.
Okay, that makes sense. P1, 1, T2, 2. What about P3?
For P3, we need the smallest KP2, so K2, that's not in C2. C2 is the set of products AB, where AB1 and AB are in the span of P1, P2, 1, 2. The only possible product is 2, 2, x 4.
So C2, 4.
Right. The smallest integer K2 that's not 4 is 3. So P3 is 3.
Okay, I'm seeing the pattern. P4.
Smallest KP3, so K3, that's not in C3. What can we build from 1, 2, 3 using factors greater than 1? We could do 2, 2 versus 4. We can do 2, 3 yield 6, and 3, 2 over 6, so C3 equals 6.
Smallest number bigger than 3, that's not 4 or 6. That's fine.
You got it. P4 equals 5, and then for P5, C4 would include 4, 6, 8, 24, 9, 33, 10, 25. The smallest number greater than 5, not on that list, is 7, because 6, 2, 3 is already constructible.
So this generates the sequence P1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13.
Exactly. It generates the standard primes, but crucially, it starts with 1. And what it fundamentally means is that this recursive process naturally generates all numbers through multiplication, and primality just sort of emerges. It's about being structurally irreducible at that point in the construction.
It's not just a property you test for, it's a role in the building process.
Precisely. And this shines a totally different light on 1. It's not some weird exception we have to deal with. In this view, it's the essential starting point, the generative foundation stone that makes the whole structure possible.
So the question isn't why leave 1 out, it's what crucial role must 1 play?
Exactly. It's the ground state, the atomic part. You need it to even begin the construction.
And Langford's paper actually proves this isn't just a neat idea, right? It argues it's mathematically necessary.
Yes, that's a key part. Theorem 3.1 argues for its foundational necessity, and Corollary 3.2 highlights its unique structural role. It's the multiplicative identity, yes, but also the generative starting point and an irreducible atom in this constructive sense. It's not just picked. It has to be there.
It reminds me of like the concept of zero or a vacuum state in physics, something that seems like nothing but is actually fundamental.
That's a very good parallel. It's the necessary ground from which complexity arises.
Wow. This really reframes that conventional exclusion of 1. It starts to feel less like a convenient definition and more like, maybe, a misunderstanding. Like, we saw the rule but missed the underlying principle.
Or perhaps a profound category error, as the paper might suggest. Treating something structurally fundamental as if it were just a definitional tweak.
This also brings up another point you mentioned, the difference between this generative recursion and the way we usually think about recursion in math.
Ah, yes, that's a crucial distinction.
Yeah.
Think about typical recursion, like calculating factorials or Fibonacci numbers. You often work backward. Fn depends on Fn1. You ask, what simpler case gives me this result?
Right, the base case is where the calculation stops.
Exactly. And in that mindset, checking for primality is sort of reactive. You take a number and test it. Can it be divided?
But this mereological approach feels different.
It's forward-looking. Starting with P11, each new term Pn plus 1 emerges, because it's the next necessary structural piece. It's not about what simpler case led to it, but what must come next to extend the system's reach without redundancy.
So it's less like solving known equations and more like discovering the fundamental laws that generate the numbers themselves, building the universe step by step.
That's a fantastic way to put it. Each prime generated this way isn't just passing a test, it's a structural innovation. It adds a new independent dimension for building future numbers. P33 emerges not just because it lacks factors, but because the existing pieces 1, 2 simply cannot construct it. The system demands 3.
This suggests a kind of logical inevitability to the primes, doesn't it? Not just arbitrary definitions.
Absolutely. The sequence 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 appears here as a unique, structurally determined path of development. It's not just a list of primes, it's the sequence dictated by this generative logic.
How else can we visualize this structure? The paper mentions graphs, I think.
Yes, the prime generation graph, GP. It's quite elegant. Imagine every natural number as a point, a vertex.
Okay.
Then you draw a directed arrow, an edge, from A to B, if you can get B, by multiplying A by one of the primes from our generated sequence P. But we exclude P1 for the edges, just use 2, 3, 5, etc.
So an edge from 2 to 6, because 6 equals 2, 3. And an edge from 3 to 6, because 6 equals 3, 2.
Exactly. And an edge from 1 to 2, 1 to 3, 1 to 5, and so on to all the primes.
What does this graph show us?
Some really cool structural properties. Theorem 4.2 highlights them. 1 is the ultimate root. No arrows point to it.
Makes sense. It's the start.
A prime number, P1, has exactly 1 incoming arrow, always originating from one. That's its graphical signature.
And composites.
They have multiple incoming arrows corresponding to their different prime factors. For example, 6 has arrows coming in from 2 and 3. 12 would have arrows from 4 via 3 and 6 via 2.
And paths in this graph relate to factorization.
Directly. Any path you trace from the root 1 to a number n corresponds to an ordered way of multiplying primes to get n.
That's a neat visualization of the fundamental theorem.
It is, and theorem 4.3 adds more. The length of the shortest path from 1 to n tells you exactly how many prime factors n has counted with multiplicity.
Like 1 and a 2 and a 4 and a 12, length 3. Factors are 2, 2, 3. 3 factors. Wow.
Precisely. And the total number of different paths from 1 to n. That equals the number of distinct ordered factorizations of n.
The paper also mentions lattice properties. How does that fit in?
Well, if you think about numbers ordered by divisibility, they form a mathematical structure called a lattice. In this lattice, operations like finding the least common multiple, LCM, or greatest common divisor, GCD, have natural interpretations.
Okay.
The key insight here is that the atoms of this lattice, the elements sitting right above the absolute bottom element, which is 1, are precisely the prime numbers, 2, 3, 5, and so on. They are the fundamental building blocks in this divisibility structure.
So the graph and the lattice structure both reinforce this idea of primes as the generative elements.
Exactly. It gives a powerful visual and structural way to understand their role. It even lets you think about highly composite numbers, numbers with lots of factors as nodes in the graph, with exceptionally high connectivity or factorization richness.
This all seems incredibly coherent for the natural numbers, but does this merry logical idea just stop there, or can it go further?
That's one of the most compelling parts. It extends quite naturally. You can define myriological integers using differences of products from our sequence P. And guess what? You get exactly the set of all integers, Z.
No way. Okay.
Then you define myriological rationals using ratios involving these integers and products from P. Again, you recover the entire set of rational numbers, Q.
So it reconstructs the familiar number systems.
It does. And then you can define myriological real numbers essentially by filling in the gaps between the rationals. A process called metric completion. You end up generating the entire real number line, R.
And does the foundational role of 1 persist through all this?
Yes, that's key. Theorem 5.6 shows that the structure built upon P11 extends consistently. 1 remains the multiplicative identity throughout the integers, rationals, and reals. Its foundational nature is preserved.
That shows incredible robustness. It's not just a trick for natural numbers. It's a perspective that scales up.
It really does. It even offers potentially new ways to think about numbers, like pi or e-transcendental numbers, as perhaps being fundamentally outside the reach of finite construction steps using the myriological primes. Okay, let's try to wrap this up. What are the main takeaways here?
Well, we've seen a rigorous, recursive way to define primes that includes 1 as the foundation. We saw it's formally equivalent to the standard definition for numbers 2 and up. It gives us these neat graph and lattice visualizations.
Right, showing primes as generators.
And remarkably, this whole structure extends smoothly from natural numbers all the way to the real number continuum.
But the core philosophical point seems to be about choice versus necessity in math.
I think so. It suggests that what looks like an arbitrary choice, excluding 1, might actually mask a deeper structural necessity that this constructive approach uncovers. 1 isn't an exception, it's the linchpin.
It really contrasts the typical test for primality, backward-looking, with this build-the-numbers, forward-looking approach. They're complementary views, absolutely. One focuses on properties, the other on generation and structure.
So the final thought for you, our listener, this myriological framework prompts a different kind of question. Not just, what is this thing? But what role does this thing play in building the whole system?
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder what other areas, maybe in science, maybe even in language or social structures, could be better understood if we shifted focus from just listing properties to understanding their generative structural role. Something to chew on.